Anyhow, Bob Arctor thought, we won't have to keep sweeping aphids out of the house after Jerry's been by to visit. He felt like laughing, thinking about it. They had, once, invented a routine, mostly Luckman had because he was good at that, funny and clever, about a psychiatric explanation for Jerry's aphid trip. It had to do, naturally, with Jerry Fabian as a small child. Jerry Fabian, see, comes home from first grade one day with his little books under his arm, whistling merrily, and there, sitting in the dining room beside his mother, is this great aphid about 4 feet high. His mother is gazing at it fondly.
What's happening?
Little Jerry Fabian inquires.
This here is your older brother, his mother says, who you've never met before. He's come to live with us. I like him better than you. He can do a lot of things you can't.
And from then on, Jerry Fabian's mother and father continually compare him unfavorably with his older brother, who is an aphid. As the two of them grow up, Jerry progressively gets more and more of an inferiority complex, naturally. After high school, his brother receives a scholarship to college, while Jerry goes to work in a gas station. After that, this brother, the aphid, becomes a famous doctor or scientist. He wins the Nobel Prize. Jerry is still rotating tires at the gas station, earning $1.50 an hour. His mother and father never cease reminding him of this. They keep saying, if only you could have turned out like your brother. Finally, Jerry runs away from home, but he still subconsciously believes aphids to be superior to him. At first, he imagines he is safe. But then, he starts seeing aphids everywhere in his hair and around the house because his inferiority complex has turned into some kind of sexual guilt, and the aphids are a punishment he inflicts on himself, etc. It did not seem funny now. Now that Jerry had been lugged off in the middle of the night at the request of his own friends, they themselves, all of them present with Jerry that night, had decided to do it. It couldn't be either postponed or avoided. Jerry, that night, had piled every goddamn object in his house against the front door, like maybe 900 pounds of assorted crap, including couches and chairs and a refrigerator and TV set, and then told everybody that a giant, super-intelligent aphid from another planet was out there preparing to break in and get him. And more would be landing later on, even if he got this one. These extraterrestrial aphids were smarter by far than any humans, and would come directly through the walls, if necessary, revealing their actual secret powers in such ways. To save himself as long as possible, he had to flood the house with cyanide gas, which he was prepared to do. How was he prepared to do this? He had already taped all the windows and doors airtight. He then proposed to turn on the water faucets in the kitchen and bathroom, flooding the house, saying that the hot water tank in the garage was filled with cyanide, not water. He had known this for a long time and was saving it for last, as a final defense. They would all die themselves, but at least it would keep the superintelligent aphids out. His friends phoned the police, and the police broke down the front door and dragged Jerry off to the NA clinic. The last thing Jerry said to them all was, "Bring my things later on. Bring my new jacket with the beads on the back." He had just bought it. He liked it a lot. It was about all he liked anymore. He considered everything else he owned contaminated. No, Bob Arctor thought, it doesn't seem funny now. And he wondered why it ever had. Maybe it had stemmed from fear, the dreadful fear they had all felt during the last weeks being around Jerry. Sometimes in the night, Jerry had told them, he prowled his house with a shotgun, sensing the presence of an enemy, preparing to shoot first, before being shot. That is, both of them. And now, Bob Arctor thought, I've got an enemy. Or anyhow, I've come onto his trail, signs of him. Another slushed creep in his final stages like Jerry. And when the final stages of that shit hits, he thought, it really does hit. Better than any special Ford or GM ever sponsored on primetime TV. A knock at his bedroom door. Touching the gun beneath his pillow, he said,
Yeah?
Mumble, mumble, Barris's voice.
Come in,
Arctor said. He reached to snap on a bedside lamp. Barris entered, eyes twinkling.
Still awake?
A dream woke me, Arctor said. A religious dream. In it, there was this huge clap of thunder, and all of a sudden, the heavens rolled aside and God appeared, and his voice rumbled at me.
What the hell did he say? Oh, yeah. I am vexed with you, my son, he said. He was scowling. I was shaking in the dream and looking up, and I said, What I do now, Lord? And he said, You left the cap off the toothpaste tube again. And then I realized it was my ex-wife.
Seating himself, Barris placed a hand on each of his leather-covered knees, smoothed himself, shook his head, and confronted Arctur. He seemed in an extremely good mood.
Well, he said briskly, I've got an initial theoretical view as to who might have systematically damaged, with malice, your cephscope, and may do it again.
If you're going to say it was Lachman.
Listen,
Barris said, rocking back and forth in agitation.
Well, what if I told you I've anticipated for weeks a serious malfunction in one of the household appliances, especially an expensive one, difficult to repair? My theory called for this to happen. This is a confirmation of my overall theory.
Arctur eyed him. Slowly sinking back down, Barris resumed his calm and bright smiling.
You,
he said, pointing.
You think I did it? Arctur said. Screwed up my own cephscope with no insurance.
Disgust and rage swelled through him, and it was late at night. He needed his sleep.
No, Barris said rapidly, looking distressed. You are looking at the person who did it. Buggered your cephscope. That was my complete intended statement, which I was not allowed to utter.
You did it.
Mystified, he stared at Barris, whose eyes were murky with a sort of dim triumph.
Why?
I mean, it's my theory that I did it, Barris said. Under post-hypnotic suggestion, evidently, with an amnesia block, so I wouldn't remember.
He began to laugh.
Later, Arctur said, and snapped off his bedside lamp. Much later.
Barris rose, dithering.
Hey, but don't you see? I've got the advanced, specialized electronic technical skills, and I have access to it. I live here. What I can't figure out, though, is my motive.
You did it 'cause you're nuts, Arctur said.
Maybe I was hired by secret forces. Barris muttered in perplexity.
But what would their motives be?
Possibly to start suspicion and trouble among us, to cause dissension to break out, causing us to be pitted against one another, all of us, uncertain of whom we can trust.
Who is our enemy, like that?
Then they've succeeded, Arctur said.
But why would they want to do that?
Barris was saying as he moved toward the door, his hands flapped urgently.
So much trouble. Removing that plate on the bottom, getting a passkey to the front door.
I'll be glad, Bob Arctur thought, when we get in the holo scanners and have them set up all over this house.
He touched his gun, felt reassured, then wondered if he should make certain it was still full of shells. But then he realized, I wonder if the firing pin is gone or if the powder has been removed from the shells and so forth and on obsessively, like a little boy counting cracks in the sidewalk to reduce his fear. Little Bobby Arctur, coming home from the first grade with his little school books, frightened at the unknown lying ahead. Reaching down, he fumbled at the bed frame, along and along until his fingers touched scotch tape. Pulling it loose, he tore from it, with Barris still in the room and watching, two tabs of Substance D mixed with quack. Lifting them to his mouth, he tossed them down his throat without water and then lay back, sighing.
Get lost, he said to Barris, and slept.
Chapter 5. It was necessary for Bob Arctur to be out of his house for a period of time in order that it be properly, which meant unerringly, bugged, phone included, even though the phone lines were tapped elsewhere. Usually, the practice consisted of observing the house involved until everyone was seen to leave it in such a fashion as to suggest that they were not going to return soon. The authorities sometimes had to wait for days or even several weeks. Finally, if nothing else worked, a pretext was arranged. The residents were informed that a fumigator or some such shuck personality was going to be coming in for a whole afternoon and everybody had to get lost until, say, 6 p.m. But in this case, the suspect Robert Arctur obligingly left his house, taking his two roommates with him,
to go check out a cephalochromoscope they could use on loan until Barris had his working again. The three of them were seen to drive off in Arctor's car, looking serious and determined. Then, later on, at a convenient point, which was a payphone at a gas station, using the audio grid of his scramble suit, Fred called in to report that definitely nobody would be home the rest of that day. He'd overheard the three men deciding to cruise all the way down to San Diego in search of a cheap, ripped-off cephscope that some dude had for sale for around $50, a smack freak price. At that price, it was worth the long drive and all the time. Also, this gave the authorities the opportunity to do a little illegal searching above and beyond what their undercover people did when no one was looking. They got to pull out bureau drawers to see what was taped to the backs. They got to pull apart pole lamps to see if hundreds of tabs sprang out. They got to look down inside toilet bowls to see what sort of little packets and toilet paper were lodged out of sight where the running water would automatically flush them. They got to look in the freezer compartment of the refrigerator to see if any of the packages of frozen peas and beans actually contained frozen dope, slyly mismarked. Meanwhile, the complicated holo scanners were mounted, with officers seating themselves in various places to test the scanners out. The same with the audio ones. But the video part was more important and took more time. And, of course, the scanner should never be visible. It took skill to so mount them. A number of locations had to be tried. The technicians who did this got paid well, because if they screwed up and a holo scanner got detected later on by an occupant of the premises, then the occupants, all of them, would know they had been penetrated and were under scrutiny and cool their activities. And in addition, they would sometimes tear off the whole scanning system and sell it. It had proven difficult in the courts, Bob Arctor reflected as he drove along the San Diego freeway south, to get convictions on theft and sale of electronic detection devices illegally installed in someone's residence. The police could only tack the bust on somewhere else, under another statute violation. However, the pushers, in an analogous situation, reacted directly. He recalled a case in which a heroin dealer, out to burn a chick, had planted two packets of heroin in the handle of her iron, then phoned in an anonymous tip on her to Wee Tip. Before the tip could be acted on, the chick found the heroin, but instead of flushing it, she had sold it. The police came, found nothing, then made a voice print on the phone tip and arrested the pusher for giving false information to the authorities. While out on bail, the pusher visited the chick late one night and beat her almost to death. When caught and asked why he'd put out one of her eyes and broken both her arms and several ribs, he explained that the chick had come across two packets of high-grade heroin belonging to him, sold them for a good profit, and not cut him in. Such, Arctor reflected, went the pusher mentality. He dumped off Luckman and Barris to do a scrounging number for the cephscope. This not only stranded both men and kept them from getting back to the house while the bugging installation was going on, but permitted him to check up on an individual he hadn't seen for over a month. He seldom got down this way, and the chick seemed to be doing nothing more than shooting meth two or three times a day and turning tricks to pay for it. She lived with her dealer, who was therefore also her old man. Usually Dan Mancher was gone during the day, which was good. The dealer was an addict too, but Arctor had not been able to figure out to what. Evidently a variety of drugs. Anyhow, whatever it was, Dan had become weird and vicious, unpredictable and violent. It was a wonder the local police hadn't picked him up long ago on local disturbance of the peace infractions. Maybe they were paid off. Or, most likely, they just didn't care. These people lived in a slum housing area, among senior citizens and the other poor. Only for major crimes did the police enter the Cromwell Village series of buildings and related garbage dump, parking lots, and rubbled roads. There seemed to be nothing that contributed more to squalor that a bunch of basalt block structures designed to lift people out of squalor. He parked, found the right urine-smelling stairs, ascended into darkness, found the door of Building 4 marked G. A full can of Drano lay before the door, and he picked it up automatically, wondering how many kids played here, and remembering for a moment his own kids and the protective moves he had made on their behalf over the years. This was one now, picking up this can. He rapped against the door with it. Presently, the door lock rattled and the door opened, chained inside. The girl, Kimberly Hawkins, peered out.
Yes?
Hey, man, he said. It's me, Bob.
What do you have there?
Can of Drano, he said.
No kidding.
She unchained the door in a listless way. Her voice, too, was listless. Kimberly was down, he could see. Very down. Also, the girl had a black eye and a split lip, and as he looked around, he saw that the windows of the small, untidy apartment were broken. Shards of glass lay on the floor, along with overturned ashtrays and Coke bottles.
You alone?
He asked.
Yeah, Dan and I had a fight and he split.
The girl, half Chicano, small and not too pretty, with the sallow complexion of a crystal freak, gazed down sightlessly, and he realized that her voice rasped when she spoke. Some drugs did that. Also, so did strep throat. The apartment probably couldn't be heated, not with the broken windows.
He beat you up.
Arctor set the can of Drano down on a high shelf over some paperback porn novels, most of them out of date.
Well, he didn't have his knife, thank God. His case knife that he carries on his belt and sheath now.
Kimberly seated herself in an overstuffed chair out of which springs stuck.
What do you want, Bob? I'm bummed. I really am.
You want him back?
Well,
she shrugged a little.
Who knows?
Arctor walked to the window and looked out. Dan Mancher would no doubt be showing up sooner or later. The girl was a source of money, and Dan knew she'd need her regular hits once her supply had run out.
How long can you go? He asked.
Another day.
Can you get it anywhere else?
Yeah, but not so cheap.
What's wrong with your throat?
A cold, she said, from the wind coming in.
You should.
If I go to a doctor, she said, then he'll see. I'm on crystal. I can't go.
A doctor wouldn't care.
Sure he would.
She listened then, the sound of car pipes irregular and loud.
Is that Dan's car? A red Ford 79 Torino?
At the window, Arctor looked out onto the rubbishy lot, saw a battered red Torino stopping, its twin exhaust exhaling dark smoke, the driver's door opening.
Yes?
Kimberly locked the door, two extra locks.
He probably has his knife.
You have a phone?
No,
she said.
You should get a phone.
The girl shrugged.
He'll kill you, Arctor said.
Not now. You're here.
But later, after I'm gone.
Kimberly reseated herself and shrugged again.
After a few moments, they could hear steps outside and then a knock on the door. Then Dan, yelling for her to open the door. She yelled back no, and that someone was with her.
Okay, Dan yelled in a high-pitched voice. I'll slash your tires!
He ran downstairs, and Arctor and the girl watched through the broken window together as Dan Mancher, a skinny, short-haired, homosexual-looking dude waving a knife, approached her car, still yelling up to her, his words audible to everyone else in the housing area.
I'll slash your tires, your fucking tires! And then I'll fucking kill you!
They bent down and slashed first one tire and then another on the girl's old Dodge. Kimberly, suddenly aroused, sprang to the door of the apartment and frantically began unlocking the various locks.
I gotta stop him! He's slashing all my tires! I don't have insurance!
Arctor stopped her.
My car's there, too.
He did not have his gun with him, of course, and Dan had the case knife and was out of control.
Tires aren't... My tires!
Shrieking, the girl struggled to open the door.
That's what he wants you to do, Arctor said.
Downstairs, Kimberly panted. We can phone the police. They have a phone. Let me go.
She fought him off with tremendous strength and managed to get the door open.
I'm going to call the police. My tires. One of them is new. I'll go with you.
He grabbed her by the shoulder. She tumbled ahead of him down the steps and he barely managed to catch up. Already she had reached the next apartment and was pounding on its door.
Open, please,
she called.
Please, I want to call the police. Please let me call the police.
Arctor got up beside her and knocked.
We need to use your phone, he said. It's an emergency.
An elderly man, wearing a gray sweater and creased formal slacks and a tie, opened the door.
Thanks,
Arctor said. Kimberly pushed inside, ran to the phone, and dialed the operator. Arctor stood facing the door, waiting for Dan to show up. There was no sound now, except for Kimberly babbling at the operator, a garbled account, something about a quarrel about a pair of boots worth $7.
He said they were his because I got them for him for Christmas,
she was babbling.
But because they were mine, I paid for them. And then he started to take them, and I ripped the backs of them with a can opener. So he...
She paused, then nodding.
All right, thank you. Yes, I'll hold on.
The elderly man gazed at Arctor, who gazed back. In the next room, an elderly lady in a print dress watched silently, her face stiff with fear.
This must be bad on you, Arctor said to the two elderly people.
Oh, it goes on all the time, the elderly man said. We hear them all night, night after night, fighting and him saying all the time he'll kill her.
We should have gone back to Denver, the elderly lady said. I told you that, we should have moved back.
Ah, these terrible fights, the elderly man said. And smashing things and the noise.
He gazed at Arctor, stricken, appealing for help, maybe, or maybe understanding.
On and on, it never does stop. And then what is worse, you know that every time...
Yes, tell him that,
the elderly lady urged.
What is worse, the elderly man said with dignity, is that every time we go outdoors, we go outside to shop or mail a letter, we step in... You know, what the dogs leave.
Dog do,
the elderly lady said with indignation. The local police car showed up. Arctor gave his deposition as a witness without identifying himself as a law enforcement officer. The cop took down a statement and tried to take one from Kimberly as the complaining party, but what she said made no sense. She rambled on and on about the pair of boots and why she'd gotten them, how much they meant to her. The cop, sitting with his clipboard and sheet, glanced up once at Arctor and regarded him with a cold expression that Arctor could not read but did not like anyhow. The cop finally advised Kimberly to get a phone and to call if the suspect returned and made any more trouble.
Oh, did you note the slashed tires? Arctor said as the cop started to leave. Did you examine her vehicle out there on the lot and note personally the number of tires slashed?
Casing slashes with a sharp instrument, recently made.
There's still some air leaking out?
The cop glanced at him again with the same expression and left with no further comment.
You better not stay here, Arctor said to Kimberly. He should have advised you to clear out, or asked if there was some other place you could stay.
Kimberly sat on her seedy couch in her debris-littered living room, her eyes lusterless again, now that she had ceased the futile effort of trying to explain her situation to the investigating officer. She shrugged.
I'll drive you somewhere, Arctor said. Do you know... some friend you could...
Get the fuck out!
Kimberly said abruptly with venom, in a voice much like Dan Mancher's, but more raspy.
Get the fuck out of here, Bob Arctor! Get lost, God damn it! Will you get lost?
Her voice rose shrilly and then broke in despair. He left and walked slowly back down the stairs, step by step. When he reached the bottom step, something banged and rolled down after him. It was the can of Drano. He heard her door lock, one bolt after another. Futile locks, he thought. Futile everything. The investigating officer advises her to call if the suspect returns. How can she without going out of her apartment? And there, Dan Mancher will stab her like he did the tires. And, remembering the complaint of the old folks downstairs, she will probably first step on and then fall dead into dog shit. He felt like laughing hysterically at the old folks' priorities. Not only did a burned-out freak upstairs night after night beat up and threaten to kill and probably would soon kill a young girl addict turning tricks, who no doubt had strep throat, if not much else besides, but in addition to that... As he drove Luckman and Barris back north, he chuckled aloud.
Dog shit,
he said.
Dog shit.
Humor in dog shit, he thought, if you can flash on it.
Funny dog shit.
Better change lanes and pass that Safeway truck, Luckman said. A hump is hardly moving.
He moved into the lane to the left and picked up speed. But then, when he took his foot off the throttle, the pedal all at once fell to the floor mat, and at the same time the engine roared all the way up furiously and the car shot forward at enormous, wild speed.
Slow down, both Luckman and Barris said together.
By now the car had reached almost 100. Ahead, a VW van loomed. His gas pedal was dead. It did not return, and it did nothing. Both Luckman, who sat next to him, and Barris, beyond him, threw up their arms instinctively. Arctor twisted the wheel and shot by the VW van to its left, where a limited space remained before a fast-moving Vette filled it up. The Corvette honked, and they heard its brakes screech. Now Luckman and Barris were yelling. Luckman suddenly reached and shut off the ignition. Meanwhile, Arctor shifted out of gear into neutral. The car slowed, and he braked it down, moved into the right-hand lane, and then, with the engine finally dead and the transmission out of gear, rolled off onto the emergency strip and came by degrees to a stop. The Corvette, long gone down the freeway, still honked its indignation, and now the giant Safeway truck rolled by them and for a deafening moment sounded its own warning air horn.
"What the hell happened?" Barris said.
Arctor, his hands and voice and the rest of him shaking, said, "The return spring on the throttle cable, the gas. It must have caught or broken." He pointed down. They all peered at the pedal, which lay still flat against the floor. The engine had revved up to its entire maximum RPM, which for his car was considerable. He had not clocked their final highest road speed, probably well over 100. And, he realized, though he had been reflexively pushing down on the power brakes, the car had only slowed. Silently, the three of them got onto the emergency pavement and raised the hood. White smoke drifted up from the oil caps and from underneath as well, and near-boiling water fizzled from the overflow spout of the radiator. Luckman reached over the hot engine and pointed.
Not the spring, he said. It's the linkage from the pedal to the carb. See? Fell apart.
The long rod lay aimlessly against the block, hanging impotently and uselessly down with its locking ring still in place.
So the gas pedal didn't push back up when you took your foot off. But,
he inspected the carb for a time, his face wrinkled.
There's a safety override on the carb, Barris said, grinning and showing his synthetic-like teeth. This system, when the linkage parts...
Why'd it part? Arctor broke in. Shouldn't this locking ring hold the nut in place? He stroked along the rod. How could it just fall off like that?
As if not hearing him, Barris continued. If, for any reason, the linkage gives, then the engine should drop down to idle as a safety factor. But it revved up all the way instead.
He bent his body around to get a better look at the carb.
This screw has been turned all the way out, he said. The idle screw, so that when the linkage parted, the override went the other way, up instead of down.
Well, how could that happen? Luckman said loudly. Could it screw itself all the way out like that accidentally?
Without answering, Barris got out his pocket knife, opened the small blade, and began slowly screwing the idle adjustment screw back in. He counted aloud. 20 turns of the screw to get it in.
To loosen the lock ring and nut assembly that holds the accelerator linkage rods together, he said, a special tool would be needed. A couple, in fact. I'd estimate it'll take about half an hour to get this back together. I have the tools, though, in my toolbox.
Your toolbox is back at the house, Luckman said.
Yes, Barris nodded. Then we'll have to get to a gas station and either borrow theirs or get their tow truck out here. I suggest we get them out here to look it over before we drive it again.
Hey, man, Luckman said loudly. Did this happen by accident, or was this done deliberately, like the Cephscope?
Barris pondered, still smiling his wily, rueful smile.
I couldn't say for sure about this.
Normally, sabotage on a car, malicious damage to cause an accident. He glanced at Arctor, his eyes invisible behind his green shades.
We almost piled up. If that vet had been coming any faster, there was almost no ditch to head for. You should have cut the ignition as soon as you realized that happened.
I got it out of gear, Arctor said, when I realized. For a second, I couldn't figure it out.
He thought if it had been the brakes... If the brake pedal had gone to the floor, I'd have flashed on it sooner, known better what to do. This was so... weird.
Someone deliberately did it, Luckman said loudly.
He spun around in a circle of fury, lashing out with both fists.
Motherfucker! We almost bought it! They fucking almost got us!
Barris, standing visible by the side of the freeway with all its heavy traffic whizzing by, got out a little horn snuff box of death tabs and took several. He passed the snuff box to Luckman, who took a few, then passed it to Arctor.
And maybe that's what's fucking us up, Arctor said, declining irritably. Messing up our brains.
Dope can't screw up an accelerator linkage and carb idle adjustment, Barris said, still holding the snuff box out to Arctor.
You'd better drop at least 3 of these. They're primo, but mild, cut with a little meth.
Put the damn snuff box away, Arctor said. He felt in his head loud voices singing, terrible music, as if the reality around him had gone sour. Everything now, the fast-moving cars, the 2 men, his own car with its hood up, the smell of smog, the bright, hot light of midday. It all had a rancid quality, as if, throughout, his world had putrefied, rather than anything else. Not so much become all at once, because of this, dangerous, not frightening, but more as if rotting away, stinking in sight and sound and odor. It made him sick, and he shut his eyes and shuddered.
What do you smell? Luckman asked. A clue, man? Some engine smell that...
Dog shit, Arctor said. He could smell it, from within the engine area. Bending, he sniffed, smelled it distinctly and more strongly. Weird, he thought. Freaky and fucking weird.